Nous allons passer maintenant à la responsabilité de Nicolas Kounthouris. C'était plus difficile pour lui parce qu'il doit nous parler de l'Europe. Et évidemment, il est très armé pour le faire puisqu'il est à la fois citoyen grec et britannique. Donc, c'est deux expériences complémentaires sur l'Europe. Donc Nicolas, il est parfaitement francophone, mais nous allons tenir l'ensemble de la table en anglais. Il est professeur de droit du travail et de droit européen à University College London. Il a enseigné à la London School of Economics, dont je rappelle qu'elle avait été créée par les Webb, les inventeurs de la notion de démocratie industrielle, et les Webb qu'il avait créé en disant qu'avec un programme très social. La London School avait un agenda social. Et il avait obtenu son doctorat sous la direction de Mark Friedland, avec lequel il a continué à collaborer. Mark Friedland a été invité à donner une conférence ici. Il est intervenu aussi dans notre colloque sur l'Europe. Ils ont publié ensemble, en 2013, un ouvrage qui s'appelle Resocializing Europe in a Time of Crisis, qui est paru à Cambridge University Press. Et il a participé à la rédaction d'un traité collectif sur le Contract of Employment avec Mark Friedland, Alan Borg et Hugh Collins. Et aussi Simon Deakin, si j'ai bien vu, dont les traités sont des ouvrages de référence sur le droit du travail britannique. I hope not to miss something important, Nicolas. And you have the floor now.
Thank you. Merci, merci. Bon après-midi à tous. Je voudrais commencer par vous remercier le collège pour l'invitation et pour l'hospitalité. Merci. C'est un plaisir. C'est un grand honneur d'être ici. Mes instructions pour aujourd'hui étaient très, très claires. On m'a dit que je devais présenter mon exposé en une langue européenne. Étant donné mes limitations linguistiques, je pensais que peut-être ça pourrait aussi être la dernière opportunité d'utiliser, ou une des dernières opportunités, non, le grec, ça va rester un peu plus long. Mais je crois pour l'anglais, pour la langue de Shakespeare, c'est peut-être une des dernières opportunités de présenter en tant que langue européenne. Après, ça va être la langue d'une publication américaine, apparemment. Donc, permettez-moi de continuer en anglais. And this presentation draws on a number of insights and intuitions that actually were originally developed by Professor Supio in his more and less recent scholarship, but in particular in his 2017 monograph, Governance by Number, which is, of course, the English translation of his earlier French monograph on the topic. And I would like to address the extent to which Uberization could emerge as a dystopian, but also as a comprehensive system for organizing both economies and societal affairs in the 21st century. I would also like to address the extent to which labor law could emerge as a force that could contrast these tendencies towards uberization of societies in the 21st century. The presentation begins by acknowledging that 20th century capitalism was far from immune to radical shakeups in the way the economic base and the processes of capital accumulation of, in particular, industrial societies was periodically reconfigured. Such shakeups were both frequent and radical in the ways they interacted with societal superstructures, including, of course, labor law, but also the organization and functioning of the state and of public affairs in general. At risk of oversimplifying a much more complex discourse, one may look at the emergence of Fordism, for instance, as one such juncture in the evolutionary trajectory of 20th century capitalism. Its vertically integrated system of production became a paradigm both for the organization of economic relations and the interaction between different factors of production within the firm and markets at large, but it also became the blueprint to shape accordingly and possibly subserviently a vast range of social relations, from patterns of consumption to the way state bureaucracies were organized and operated, to important aspects of human interaction and regulation, including to a certain extent labor law and social security law. Incidentally, and this is a point that was admirably clarified already by Professor Supio's work, the state also shaped its government and governance structures accordingly. Large, vertically integrated ministerial bureaucracies became the paradigm model for administering the res publica across the globe, from Rome to New York, from Moscow to Delhi. For this arguably just partial displacement, but what is sometimes referred to as Toyotism, was also ripe with important consequences and changes in the way both economic and societal affairs in industrialized and increasingly in post-industrial societies were organized and regulated. Arguably, for us, the labor law community, at least, the most significant of such changes was the idea that it was both possible and necessary to reconfigure labor law along the concepts of a fairly secure and functionally flexible core workforce on the one hand, and a more precarious and numerically flexible periphery of the labor market on the other. Labor law was asked to facilitate this division between core and periphery, between secure and numerically flexible and precarious, and in many ways it did so. The 1980s and the 1990s were really across the board, I would say, two decades in which labor law was tested to the limit in terms of its ability to accept and accommodate these forms, as they were called, of atypical work. Most European countries throughout those two decades dismantled 40 or 50 years worth of limits to labor law, only subcontracting, collective agreement, and working practices that have prohibited or discouraged non-standard work, and introduced swathes of legislation. We've seen some European directives to that effect that accepted and at times even encouraged part-time work, fixed-time work, temporary agency work, and so on. These were profound changes that also affected the way the public sector operated, especially in some European countries. Downsizing, outsourcing, agencification became familiar concepts in the operation of both central and especially local government infrastructure. It was not just about lean production, but especially in the UK, it was also about lean government. Having introduced this narrative in a rather obviously critical vein, my presentation goes on to assess in an equally critical manner the extent to which, after Ford and Toyota, we may be on the verge of being exposed to a new third model for the radical shake-up of our economic and societal affairs, namely Uberism, a third type of car coming along the road. The term Uberism is used here as a generic term, referring to the growing process of digitalization of economic relations. According to authors such as Amit Ekbia and Bonnie Nardi, such processes are transforming the division of labor between humans and machines, and they're shifting many people into work that is hidden, poorly compensated, or accepted as part of being a user, not a worker, a user of digital technology. This extraction of economic value from low cost or free labor in computer-mediated networks is rapidly emerging as a new process of capital accumulation, and it's laying its claim, I think, as a structural facet of 21st century capitalist societies. Ostensibly, this model could carry with it the same transformative effect on both the way capitalist societies organize and operate the systems of production, and also in the way they tend to arrange other economic and societal affairs. There are already suggestions in some quarters that the uberization and digitalization of our economies ought to be accompanied, if not assisted, by a recognition that growing shares of the workforce could or should be used on a contingent, on-demand basis, either as provider of services or even as mere users. We're talking about core workers, not just periphery workers. In fact, uberization is trying to blur this tenuous distinction between a protected core and a precarious periphery. For instance, in 2015, Harrison Kruger, two American economists, suggested that a new category of independent worker ought to become the central organizing concept for large sections of the labor law book in order to accommodate work relations in the online and gig economy. 2 years ago in the UK, Matthew Taylor suggested that a similar role ought to be occupied by the concept of dependent contractor. From this perspective, one could see the growing intervention of competition law and competition authorities in this particular area of labor market regulation as an indication of the pressures currently mounting on labor law to modernize perhaps all the cases that have gone before the European Court of Justice and before some national European competition authorities, such as the FMV Kumsten case, are not really about on-demand orchestra players or session musicians or freelance journalists in the Irish case. Maybe they're just the prelude to deeper and more structural adjustments. In the same vein, we ought to consider the possibility that the growing calls for universal social security coverage, which are also visible at an EU level, there is a recommendation on this topic currently pending, might be an attempt to obscure some of the redistributive responsibilities that, at least in part, ought to be shouldered by employers and apportioning these responsibilities of the labor market risks in the direction of an increasingly tax-starved society. Such claims and demands are unsurprisingly spanning beyond the domain of labor market or social regulation, with the emergence of increasingly prescriptive suggestions in some quarters about government and the public sector being redesigned by the use of algorithms and artificial intelligence. A very interesting report produced by Deloitte on artificial intelligence augmented government using cognitive technologies to redesign public sector work makes a very, very interesting read. Uberization does not just obscure the continuing contribution of labor to the processes of wealth creation. It also seeks to obscure the fact that government, and this is another theme that has been expanded by Professor Supio's work, it also seeks to obscure the fact that government and the regulation of labor markets are and have to remain an essentially normative and therefore an essentially and deeply democratic exercise. If governance by numbers was problematic enough in terms of its legitimacy and accountability, I would suggest that governance by algorithms poses even greater challenges to our understanding of the functioning of democratic systems of government and what Professor Supio has termed economic democracy. You see, governance by numbers rendered processes subservient to reaching particular quantitatively defined objectives. That was bad enough. But governance by algorithms objectifies the very processes themselves in a way that seeks to democratically sterilize and render opaque and unchallengeable not just the ends, but also the means to reach those ends. Governance by algorithms blurs even the tenuous distinction between quantitatively attainable objectives and the programs or processes that are needed in order to attain them. The means and the end, the outcome and the process, all collapse within a single numerical entity, the algorithm. My presentation goes on to suggest that governance by algorithms is neither a given, and this is the good news, nor a plausible proposition for regulating capital and labor, let alone democracies, in the 21st century. It postulates that some of the key transformations that affected 20th century capitalism, capitalist societies, took place due to the coming into play of three necessary elements, some of which are currently missing. Firstly, there was a series of structural and technological transformations inherent to the changing power relations between capital and labor, technology. Secondly, as a consequence of a number of conjunctural factors, including the emergence of facilitating regulatory superstructures such as labor law reforms and social security systems. And thirdly, because of the emergence of supporting and facilitating cultural and political narratives. Who doesn't remember a very important American publication in the 1990s that really brokered Toyotism and just-in-time production, the machine that changed the world, by Womack, Jones, and Roos? It definitely changed the world. Now, of course, we have the technology. We've heard this yesterday, and I think it has become even clearer to me that the potential of this technology is impressive. But I think on the third point, the point of the narrative, I think we're also not scoring particularly well. We are, in fact, witnessing the powerful emergence of narratives that tend to broker, to support and facilitate Uberism. Valerio De Stefano has already noted how the language of Uberism is laden with such facilitating terms, and how works like gigs, on-demand, crowdsourcing, service provider and user all serve to construct a narrative that obscures the important contribution of work, of labor, to this process of accumulation of wealth. I'm afraid that some of the suggestions that are increasingly put by some economists and even labor lawyers, the example of Harrison Kruger and Matthew Taylor come back to mind, are also an indication of this emerging narrative. But it is fair to say that this remains a time of contestation and also a time of counter-narrative. The unprecedented and growing levels of inequality affecting Western democracy is generating and is likely to continue to generate a series of countervailing narratives, some of which we've heard from other presentations this afternoon. And these narratives are entrenching considerable levels of resistance to any structural transformations of the economy that are likely to exacerbate the current trends in wealth and power distributions. I think we're rediscovering, as labor lawyers, we're also rediscovering the important reallocative and redistributive potential of labor law in the 21st century. I will quickly elaborate on this point in my concluding comments. Labor always asks for its fair share of the pie. Look no further than the ILO Declaration of Philadelphia to see how redistribution was a very important purpose of labor law in the second half of the 20th century. It probably never got a fair share of the pie, but it made substantial claims to it, especially through collective bargaining processes. Now, governance by algorithms seeks to cut labor out of this share altogether. At a basic, one would almost say disingenuous level, it seeks to do so by converting workers into either self-employed persons or micro-businesses. It further seeks to reshape some relations as commercial relations between users and providers. The word customer appears in most contracts of the gig economy. And finally, it reshapes some acts that undeniably generate value in the market chain as activities or actions, but not work. Ekpe and Nardi's concept of heteromation reveals this travesty for what it is. These are the words from the recent book on heteromation, page 32. Capital uses computing to extract low or no-cost labor in networks to sustain the growth of profits. People are not sitting idle without work. We're working in new ways, ways that sometimes exacerbate precarity. Looking ahead, heteromated labor may be contributing to a system of tiny moments of economically valuable labor that return little to the worker but sustain wealthy, powerful companies. I think it falls upon us to resist these trends. The pie that we need to claim a share of is the pie of wealth accumulation, of wealth creation. And this is a pie that remains essentially shaped by human labor in its interaction with capital. In order to do so, however, We need to reconceptualize labor in order to provide a new central organizing idea. For that system of distribution and redistribution, the labor law was, is, or ought to be. Several progressive regulatory reform proposals seek to address this challenge, and in the concluding section of my presentation, I will engage with three of these progressive proposals. The first set of proposals doesn't fundamentally challenge, I think, the concept of a binary divide between subordinate employment and independent self-employment. However, it advocates an extension of some selected and universal and fundamental labor rights beyond the narrow confines of subordinate employment and onto the self-employed. One can find an organized articulation of these ideas in proposals such as the ones contained in the 2016 Carta dei diritti universali del lavoro, produced by the Italian trade union, CGL, but also in a very interesting recent 2019 report produced by the ILO, Work for a Brighter Future, that articulates a universal labor guarantee as a way forward. These proposals go hand in hand with a growing recognition that certain fundamental labor rights, such as the right to bargain collectively, not to be discriminated against, or to work in a healthy and safe work environment with maximum working hours, ought to apply to all workers, regardless of their status. And in this sense, a recent decision by the European Committee of Social Rights in the case of ICTU versus Ireland, decided in December 2018, is a very interesting and practical illustration of this approach. In this case, the committee recognized that freelance workers in Ireland, self-employed workers in Ireland, were covered by Article 6 of the Social Charter. These are important and incremental proposals. However, my view is that by failing to address the growing heterogeneity of the self-employed category, the redistributive and risk allocative potential is either bound to be hampered by accusations of overreaching. We have a number of antitrust competition authorities that are doing exactly that, or by an underwhelming process of auto-amputation. Presumably, rights such as unfair dismissal, as we know it, would not extend to all self-employed unless they were watered down to a meaningless notion of breach of contract, and in a way result in leveling down existing protections instead of ratcheting them up. A second set of proposals identifies the idea of economic dependence as the defining element of work and the new central organizing idea for labor law reform. This is an old idea, but in many ways it has been revitalized by the excellent and compelling work led by Professor Doquesse and his colleagues in Proposition de Code du Travail, published by the Laws in 2017. Economic dependence could function in their work as an add-on to the concept of subordination to expand the notion of worker and expand the personal scope of application of labor law. Emmanuel probably knows this, but the Swedish trade union TCO recently led an empirical survey on some 9,000 self-employed persons providing services to other businesses or public authorities and found that some 13% of them had not had more than one client in the previous year, and an additional 16.5% of them had only contracted with no more than three, suggesting that economic dependence could expand substantially the reach of labor law. However, I would suggest that even this positive extension of the scope of labor law is likely to be undermined by a growing uberization of worker relations. In fact, it's unlikely to be able to control its expansion. More and more workers in the gig economy are increasingly earning their living through a variety of platforms and clients. And as the number of platforms and the number of gig workers grow, and as exclusivity clauses for on-call and self-employment contracts become more and more unpalatable in most European legal systems, the likelihood of a gig worker offering her labor through a growing number of digital intermediaries and to a growing number of clients, customers, or principals increases exponentially. A third option is the more radical set of proposals put forward by a group of labor law experts in the United Kingdom in a publication entitled The Manifesto for Labor Law, coordinated and edited by Keith Ewing, John Handy, and Kat Jones, and recently endorsed both by the UK trade union movement and by the Labour Party in opposition. These proposals pivot around a new definition of worker defined as the person engaged by another to provide labour and who is not genuinely operating a business in her or his own account. This is a definition closely linked to the concept of personal work relation developed by Professor Mark Friedland and seeks to generally break the mold of the traditional binary divide between employment and self-employment by including within the concept of worker all forms of remunerated work, whether contractual or relational, whether subordinate, dependent or autonomous, whether formal or informal, leaving outside the scope of labor law only work that is not personal. That is to say, work that is mainly, as opposed to occasionally, or exceptionally provided by means of substitutes or dependents, or work that is provided as an accessory to capitalize an asset-intensive, as opposed to labor-intensive, business undertakings. Now, these are new ideas, but they're actually not so new, since the divide between capital and labor is not exactly today's news. Don't take my word for good. If I may, take a look at Article 35 of the Italian Constitution of 1948, expressly providing that la Repubblica tutela il lavoro in tutte le sue forme e applicazioni, which I believe that in today's newspeak we'd have to translate as the Republic protects work in all its forms and apps. Now, the uberization of economic systems is posing and will continue to pose fundamental challenges to the traditional ways in which we have organized our societies, our economies, and our systems of wealth redistribution, including labor law. I think we're really called upon identifying new ways to identify labor. But labor has not, and it will not disappear. In saying so, and this is really my conclusion, I would like to conclude by quoting, or rather paraphrasing, a very beautiful phrase that Professor Supior has taught us. Labor will not disappear because it is inherently part of the human condition. Not because it helps humans to satisfy their basic need, or certainly not solely because of that. This is so in particular because it's linked to the insatiable thirst of humans to change and transform the world that surrounds them, hopefully in a better way. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much, dear Nicolas. Perhaps as you are here, you could give a brief summary in French of your presentation.
Yeah. Is it a serious offer?
It's not an order, it's an offer.
It's an order. Donc, ce que j'essayais de faire, et pardonnez-moi, ça c'était une surprise, ce que j'essayais de faire, c'était d'articuler une idée à propos du concept d'ubérisation comme une idée potentielle pour restructurer non seulement les économies, mais aussi la société et le travail dans le 21e siècle, un peu comme les Fordisme, les post-Fordisme, les Toyotisme avaient été capables de le faire pour les sociétés capitalistes et les économies capitalistes dans le 20e siècle. Et j'essayais de identifier quelles sont les trajectoires essentiel pour qu'un certain système technologique puisse aspirer à devenir un système d'organisation de l'économie et de la société. Je crois, dans mon travail, j'essayais d'identifier au moins trois conditions préalables pour qu'une technologie puisse aspirer à transformer d'une façon radicale l'économie et la société. La première, c'est les moyens techniques. Et on a entendu hier que ce n'est pas à cause d'un défaut de technologie que l'ubérisme ne va pas prévaloir comme système d'organisation de l'économie. Un deuxième aspect, c'est un discours qui soutient le développement d'une certaine technologie comme technologie hégémonique. Et malheureusement, le discours qui soutient l'ubérisme incorpore presque automatiquement des traits, même linguistiques, qui essayent de dévaloriser le concept de travail, de le transformer ou réduire des sous-catégories qui rien ont à faire avec le droit du travail, comme l'activité ou le droit de l'utilisateur, la consommation, et soi-disant. Et la troisième condition, je crois, ça devrait être une pulsion des systèmes de réglementation sociale et du droit du travail qui accompagne ou facilite, comme ça s'est passé dans le passé. Par exemple, dans les années 80 et dans les années 90, le droit du travail a soutenu l'évolution post-fordiste de l'économie, la création d'une périphérie de travailleurs qui n'étaient pas protégés. Ça s'est passé même grâce aux transformations du droit du travail. Et je me demande si cela est en train de se produire maintenant d'une façon qui faciliterait l'expansion de l'ubérisme comme notion forte de l'organisation des économies et des sociétés capitalistes du XXIe siècle. Et là, je ne crois pas que cela soit en train de se produire. Je vois très très bien qu'il y a des pressions pour que cela se passe. Il y a même des auteurs, des économistes, même des collègues qui ont fait des propositions pour que cela arrive. Mais il y a aussi de très fortes résistances. Et j'ai identifié trois exemples de narratives alternatives à ces propositions. La première est celle de qui est poursuivi par exemple par un syndicat italien, mais d'un certain côté, pour certains aspects aussi par l'OIT, l'idée d'individuer des droits du travail qui sont des droits fondamentaux et donc qui doivent s'appliquer aussi aux travailleurs autonomes, et pas seulement aux salariés. Une deuxième stratégie, c'est la stratégie qui est poursuivie par des collègues français qui ont fait une série de très très fortes propositions basées sur l'idée d'expandre la catégorie du travail pour y comprendre non seulement le travail subordonné, mais aussi le travail qui est économiquement dépendant par l'employeur. Et une troisième proposition, c'est une proposition qui, paradoxiquement, s'est manifesté en Angleterre, mais ce n'est pas vraiment un paradoxe. Et c'est l'idée d'attribuer les droits du travail à toutes les personnes qui contribuent du travail, pas de l'emploi, mais vraiment le labor, par exclusion de ceux qui le font en tant que entrepreneurs, donc qui emploient des autres au lieu de contribuer du travail personnel à l'activité de l'employeur, et par exclusion aussi de ceux qui contribuent du travail, mais d'une façon, I can't find the word in English or French,
in Greek.
Le seul mot grec qui me vient dans la tête maintenant, c'est pornos, donc qui est subservient, qui sert une offre de capital, donc qui n'est pas labor intensive mais capital intensive. Et sur ce point-là, je vais m'arrêter vraiment.
Thank you.
Merci beaucoup.